First, I'm going to read from this book, Agony, which is a sort of long confessional poem that uses discourse of mathematics to kind of ground the anecdotes and the logical convolutions and the speculations about my own life. Self-portrait as beautiful flower. Look at me. My right hand index finger is 3.4 inches long, whether pointing at myself or not. If I sliced 2 inches from it, it would be 1.4 inches long. I could still point at myself or at anything else. For example, this flowerless vase with a circumference of 15 inches at widest, which I used to be able to more or less comfortably grip, but which now, if I've sliced 2 inches from all my fingers, slides right out of my hands. Given that the 2-inch slice would cut directly into the knuckle of my index finger, I could then fit the leftover stub into this vase until my half a knuckle stopped up by the lip, as a cork is stopped up by a bottle. This stopping is due to the knuckle's width and not to the fatness of the finger. Thus, the further slicing of the fingers would free up their essential thinness and allow for a greater versatility with regards to fitting into holes. The pinky finger of my right hand is now 0.8 inches long. The ring finger of my right hand is now 1.4 inches long. The middle finger of my right hand is now 1.75 inches long. The thumb of my right hand is now 0.45 inches long. So, if I sliced 2 or more inches from my fingers, I'd end up cutting jaggedly into my palm, which would thus retain the same asymmetry that my hand already retains with all its fingers in full. But my arm, if measured from shoulder to scar, would only stretch for 23.75 inches, with no chance of holding this vase in any usual sense of holding, though I could still lift this vase from below by planting its foot in my palm and balancing it there as if I were a pedestal or, what is more likely, a coffee table. And instead of pointing at it in any usual sense of pointing, I could describe it in another kind of usual sense. But having no vocabulary for the design or description of vases, it appears to me as pottery, generically, much as an unfamiliar taste appears to one as the generic form of spice, before such generality is once again subsumed by the pretty much unavoidable nominalism of the familiar, that is, what has happened more than twice. And so my description would be without content, but not without shape, like the inside of this vase, or the invisible outline of where my fingers used to be, as intimated by my suggestively rounded and truncated palms, whose 5 baby pink and half-formed bulbs refer back to a time before truncation, as if there were one. So, yeah, look at this. The pinky finger of my left hand is then 0.8 inches long. The ring finger of my left hand is then 1.6 inches long. The middle finger of my left hand is then 1.8 inches long. The index finger of my left hand is then 1.6 inches long. The thumb of my left hand is then 0.45 inches long. So the ring and index fingers of my left hand are each 0.2 inches longer than the complementary fingers of my right hand, and the middle finger of my left hand is 0.05 inches longer than the other one. I didn't know this until I started measuring the length of my fingers as if 2 inches were sliced from each. But this is not getting creative in the usual sense. Getting creative in the usual sense has to do entirely with becoming a more resourceful employee, and my fantasy of slicing myself up involves instead the excessively literal subtraction of my body from the job market. When you can't point to yourself, you can't make a good employee. An employer needs you to be able to point to yourself creatively to ensure that blame is self-reflexive, not even in a more complicated spiraling involution of guilt, but first and only ever in the empty formal act of pointing, directed wholly by yourself, toward yourself, for any lag in performance, ability, or attitude. My left foot big toe is exactly 2 inches long, gone. My right foot big toe is exactly 2 inches long, gone. The remaining toes are shorter than 2 inches, and so the removal of 2 inches from each of them means the renunciation of my feet as unities. They then become infinitely divisible, like footsteps. Having 2 inches sliced for my toes definitely fucks the way I walk. It's steadier now, my fantasy, not because of a more ideal distribution of bipedal weight, but because of an increased attention to the necessary work of not falling over, which attention grants the whole affair, that is, the suggestive verticality of walking, the same kind of stiff aristocratic inevitability that plagues the actual affairs of the rich, that is, their love affairs, at least insofar as I imagine their lives to be sterile, devoid of passion, even and especially at any passionate peaks, unlike, say, walking, as I used to do it before slicing off 2 inches off my toes, when it was dangerous and carried with it not only my body from one place to another, but the possibility, nay, likelihood, of a fall, which is never sterile, for usually I am just like the rich, overly attentive to the miracle of uprightness, ignoring the haphazard wobble that betrays such uprightness as miraculous in the first place. That is, I exaggerate the erection of my posture in deference to the unlikely extravagance of our evolution, thus forfeiting my chances of becoming prone, without which I can know no miracles. For example, without miracles, there'd be no way to lift this vase without fingers, or to fit my short foot into its 1-inch mouth. In fact, without miracles, there's nothing much I could do with this thing except look at it, given the inches sliced away. Unless, that is, even more inches were sliced, until there were once again made open to me an active relationship to this vase. Look here, I'm about to get creative. We could slice 2 inches from each side, right and left, of my right foot, which is at widest 4.25 inches, and the remaining 0.25 inches might still be reasonably called a foot. Same for the left, though that foot is only 0.415 inches at the widest, and so the remaining sliver would be even slimmer, though still, without question, a foot. Plus, my left hand is 4.5 inches at widest, which is surprising only insofar as who would have thought that one's hands and feet would have so nearly the same width at widest. So if the 2 inches were sliced from both sides, right and left, I'd be left, as it were, with a 0.5 inch wide left hand. Same for the right hand. So now the total width of my hands and feet, which no longer vainly boast fingers or toes, would be 1.4 inches, still too wide to fit into the 1-inch mouth of this empty vase. And given that, in my fantasy, I can only slice 2 inches off my body at a time, I cannot simply slice the excess 0.4 inches from one of my narrower extremities. It's not so simple. The only thing to do is hold my hands, because I'm not agile enough to stretch my feet up to my face, and to simultaneously slice 2 inches from my face and my hands, as if they were one, say, by slicing 1.5 inches from my face and 0.5 inches from my hands, leaving me with one big 0.5 inch hand, or two 0.25 inch hands, hard to say, and a slightly slimmer face, which won't necessarily directly assist in my venture to imagine myself as unemployable, but will certainly indirectly assist in such imagining, insofar as any potential employer who has to look at my mangled little face will in all likelihood be less likely to hire me even than he or she might if I showed up with simply worthless hands and feet dangling from my arms and legs like cut rubber bands, which perhaps at least it would be easy for one to grace with the shitty gift of pity, but a face asymmetrical and skimpy as everyone imagines their own to be when not looking in a mirror, when it seems like that misshapen mound of meat can't possibly show off enough of what's so special about you to account for your recognizability as a discrete continuity, can it? And will my cut-up face affect the sound of my voice? Will I sound more like a woman supposedly sounds? Because women have less of a chance of being hired when up against a male competitor, and so I'm giving up the one advantage I wonder if I even have, which is exactly what I want to do, paradise on earth, become absolutely lacking in advantage, the closest one can get to God, who, however you slice it, is infinitely divisible at the very least and doesn't work. Miracles are proof of only this. They don't count as work, but instances in which what's been working well enough suddenly blinks off. That is, miracles are just really bad accidents. Hands and feet together now 0.9 inches. Finally, I can fit myself into this vase. I slip 2 hands at a total of 0.5 inches and 2 feet at a total of 0.4 inches into its 1-inch mouth and curl up as worthlessly as possible. Before, when I hadn't yet systematically sliced 2 inches off my body over and over again, my time was valuable. It was worth something to someone. But now I'm only as valuable as this vase, not very, and not even continuously, like labor power, but only once, upon purchase, then poof, value's gone, at least until resold. And so, yeah, since I'm no longer worth anything as a worker, I'm worth something in and of myself, that is to say, in and of this vase I'm in. As such, I have no need for pointing, and without pointing, I'm without blame, like a flower, which is maybe why flowers are beautiful. They only seem to point at you when you pay for them, and then, horrifically, like your grown-up children, never blame you for anything ever again, instead indifferently withering away without even the good grace to blame themselves for their worthlessness, which might at least inspire a spasm of guilt for you, which guilt could then be someday forgotten. But it's a shame, flowers don't arouse enough guilt for us to forget them or even repress them, but are instead so pointless as to be but barely remembered. And this here is my object, not to be ashamed, but to be a shame, a feeling pretty much impossible to recall, but which nonetheless permeates all recollection it touches, like a flower, to be but barely for you. And now I'm going to read from the second book of this series, which will be called Bribery. And if the first book uses math to filter and account for myself, the second one uses degraded forms of psychology. So I use corporate and government psychological profiles of criminals to analyze my nuclear family and discover which of them would most likely be which kind of criminal. However, I'm not going to read any of those because they're too long for this evening. But I'm going to read three interludes. There are three interludes in the book, which are descriptions of my corpse. I suppose I'll say, with regards to the program, that if these poems suffer under the image, they probably do so at the level of syntax and not so much at the level of the content described. Composite sketch. When I am dead, I look like this, a dot. And, as is nearly always the case for dots, I don't seem to represent any actual circular thing, such as a head seen from enough of a distance that it looks like a round blob, but rather the negative space issued in the absence of something else, such as the same head turned on its side, say, so the viewer just sees what the head would see if the head was dreaming about seeing inside itself and wasn't cut off. In other words, or in the same words, I look like a dot in the way a messy neck of a severed head looks like a dot to itself in a dream. It might be difficult to differentiate the slimy organic materials spilling out, but they nonetheless create the distinct impression of having had once added up to something, though that something, of course, has since been obscured by its separation from the body, which body, when it was one, ordered the slosh of its contents somewhat logically, so that they seem to form a whole, but which now, in two pieces, prove to be infinite insofar as the leaked and cracked parts may take on any number of forms and come to rest in any number of positions, depending on air pressure and gravity and inclination and temperature and humidity and the various qualities of the soil, if it's sitting in the soil, or the hardness of the pavement, if it's propped on pavement, and the amount of sunlight that lights it up and heats the soil or pavement underneath it, and countless other factors like microbes, which I won't even try to count because you get the idea. It's a simple idea, just that the neck of a severed head seems to represent a particular thing, but in its many possible poses never quite looks like that thing, and instead remains suggestive of something that never quite appears, like a dot. Which is how I got all wet. My clothes are soaked, my shirt is soaked, my hat is soaked, my gloves are soaked, my socks are spongy, as if submerged in mud, like walking barefoot along the rim of a lake. And it's all over me, the sleeves of my jacket suck to my sides, and with each step and attendant swing of the shoulders, they splatter against the sides of my torso, which is, of course, swaddled in the same drowned jacket, buttoned once over the tightening waist of my soppy pants. The blood pools in the cuffs and overflows directly into the shoes, which make embarrassing sloshing sounds at every step, so that if I'm trying to follow anyone, they'll hear me coming. They'll run. And I'm wearing a tie. It's plain and thin and engorged. The knot has swollen to the size of a baby's fist. But let's be honest. This comparison doesn't clear anything up, given that not only are no two babies' fists the same, but more importantly, the word baby doesn't exactly narrow anything down. And we can all agree that the difference between, for example, a one-year-old baby and a one-week-old baby and a one-year-old baby renders the analogy a sloppy frivolity at best and a meaningless flourish at worst. But the reason I employ it anyway is simple and good. I want to be just imprecise enough to have you think of the knot as a blobby pink thing with no real boundaries clawing at my headless bleeding throat, which is a far more menacingly emotional image than a more precise description or definitional measurement of an actual baby's shriveled little limp fist might allow. So, let's say the knot has swollen to the size of that baby's fist and loosened. The blood runs down the length of the silk and streams off the tip and collects on the brim of my pants before flowing down my legs in rivers and branches, absolutely mindless, self-erasing tributaries squirming absolutely mindlessly toward their writhing reflections pretended in the hot oily puddles rainbowing circles around my feet. Composite sketch. When I am dead, I look like this, a list. Not any particular list. In fact, I potentially include all things, including all lists, accounted for and enumerated, if not known. Just a list and nothing more, the racks-to-death form of one thing after another pulled to pieces and lined up in rows as a thought is cut from consciousness and slipped into a sequence of thoughts without the thinker even knowing it, giving them the impression of their own consistency. In this way, we can assume that the list is the form proper to assumption, insofar as it assumes whatever within it, without distinction, like the howl of a dog that won't let you sleep, or the whimper of the same dog that affects the same result. The brain attempts to push it out, and this pushing fills it up, so that all one thinks is how to push, not even in order to sleep, not yet, you're not even tired anymore anyway, but merely to remove the necessity of pushing, which totals the brain and puts it all to one purpose, at least consciously, so that everything else, the rest of the world, is wiped clean, blank as sound, so for that moment, one has one brain, our brain, that is, the feeling of being of one mind, ours, not in some quasi-transcendental solidarity which functions to construct in us, but in the pressure put on us to push the others out, delimiting ourselves to the perception of a sound, and that's all, which subsumes all other sounds and thoughts within it, like a list. One thing is like another, which is why, once, when we were kids, my sister hid under my bed while I slept, not at first to watch me, obviously, since she couldn't see through the mattress, but to listen, because she had had, the night before, a dream in which I'd been taken under the cover of darkness, which, as it happened, was my own personal pet fear, that I'd wake up to a blinding light blacking out the window and that shadowy beings would walk toward me from within that light, perhaps parents or policemen, but I don't really know, the beings themselves being not so important as the shocking brightness of their lights, and they paralyzed me with the magic or handcuffs and carry me limp-limbed out the window, probably to be examined by other beings like them, but more official. And so because my sister's dream corresponded to my own waking fantasy so closely that it seemed to her a fateful coincidence, she decided to hide near me so as to protect me, if not with physical force, then by screaming until someone more equipped to dispense with beings rushed in, perhaps a parent or policeman. When no brightness came, she found herself staring at the underside of my mattress for hours, trying to keep herself awake by imagining the positions and shapes of my sleeping body. She could hear me squirm around now and again. She could see the mattress shift on the wire frame and pictured my limbs sprawled in such a way as to match that frame, so that my arms and legs crisscrossed and maybe even here and there twisted up like those fat little springs that tie the wire, and soon even the rest of my body conformed to the sag and shape of the frame, so that it seemed as if I were drawn of no more than lines met into diamonds. That sleeping revealed the true shape of my body to be grid-like and extending in all directions as far as she could see, which was not far, since her eyes were too close to the frame to see anything other than it in the mattress, which was also patterned with diamonds. There must be something soothing about the shape of diamonds to have given it such prominence in the architecture of beds and, now that I think of it, chain-link fences, perhaps the possibility of interlocking endlessly, almost genetically, without disruption of form, as if sleeping and portioning out property were a preview of some blank immortality, and we feel as if our bodies were designed for this, or even as this, and this was our fate. Someday, my sister will wake up under that bed again, I'll be gone, and she'll slip off unnoticed. Composite sketch. When I am dead, I look like this, a cone, just a cone, drawn with those few strokes minimal to its definition, two straight lines forming a V in an oval representing the mouth, where whatever goes into the cone goes in this case, nothing much, which is what's just about the whole constructing. It's just a cone, and not a lot could be conceivably added to it or put into it without altering dramatically and forever its status. If we were to put something recognizable in the cone, say a scoop of delicious bloody strawberry ice cream, then the cone would cease to be just a cone and would immediately begin to perform a very particular function, that of the ice cream cone. And as soon as the cone has become an ice cream cone, it can never be just again, unless you thought of it as just a part of something else, that is, a part of a larger construction, say, for example, the construction dog eating an ice cream cone it found on the ground, or dog lapping at an ice cream cone held by a crying child. These are just two examples, more are possible. Anyway, the point is simply that if I look like just a cone in itself and not like a cone that functions as one part of a larger series of relations, then as a corpse I am very alone. But now, if we assume that even when a thing is in itself, it is part of other things, then the way I look when I am dead necessarily becomes more complex, or rather, the way we might describe how I look when I am dead becomes more complex, and each representational attempt becomes submerged in another, until I am just parts of constructions within parts of constructions, such as dog eating an ice cream cone it found on the ground while being rained on by clouds of mysterious chemicals dropped from an unmarked enemy plane, so that the ice cream is melted by a thin toxic film fell from the sky, and though the toxic substance in question isn't absorbed into the skin so easily, unlike, say, white phosphorus is, it's totally deadly if ingested, which is just what the dog is doing, ingesting it, which will kill it, the dog, probably almost immediately, and then a policeman will find its body while out looking for my body, and will decide to report it or not to report it, depending on his mood and intensity of boredom on this particular uneventful night. And so then, I look just like that, altogether, which is all by itself just a part of something smaller, like a cone. And if the delicious, bloody, strawberry ice cream cone looks more like the inside of an animal, say, a cat, then we can assume that the light pinkness of the ice cream, especially in the context of the light brownness of the cone, represents the abstract bio-slush of a body's insides, normally so invisibly interior, but which can be made visible, for example, by the introduction of a slit in the throat of a cat, which maybe a dog made when the weird chemicals in the air made it hungry, or the dog was already hungry, or the dog's family environment gradually made it hungrier and hungrier, either because its owners didn't feed it, or because they fed it too much, and it expected more and more food until eventually it had to resort to eating cats to slitting their throats with its teeth and sucking out their insides sloppily, so that the cat was just a mess when the dog was done. And the dog was just a mess, too, its mouth and snout all slippery with cat slime. And because we started out with the assumption that I am the part being described, that is, that my corpse is the thing being described, then we can assume that I am just a mess, this mess. And the fact that I appear as just a cone is indicative of that, insofar as the cone is just a cone, it excludes all that might fit into it, such as the insides of this cat, and this exclusion creates a mess mess that surrounds the cone and comes to define it by leaving it empty, like a corpse, which, like a cone before it's filled with strawberry ice cream, is not filled with strawberry ice cream, and doesn't resemble the insides of anything spilling out into the hot, empty world without me. Thank you.